Good evening, and thank you for joining us tonight for A Feminist Perspective. This weekly radio broadcast is sponsored by the Women's Resource and Career Planning Center, a program and information service of the Dean of Women's Office, 220 Strong Hall. Located in the Women's Resource and Career Planning Center is a large lending resource service which contains vast amounts of information in the form of news clippings, government documents, magazine articles, research studies, and books pertaining to the many aspects of the women's movement. These materials are as valuable for men as they are for women, since sex role definitions and stereotypes affect both sexes, so we invite all our listeners to come up and browse through the Resource Center. And we invite you, of course, to come in and take advantage of the many services offered by the Dean of Women's Office, 220 Strong Hall. Tonight, we have two guests, Vicki Hamer, who's a graduate student in the Department of Speech Communication, Human Relations, and is a research assistant in the Office of Affirmative Action, and Shirley Feldman, who is a graduate student at KU in psychology and is working on research on the attitudes of and about women. Our topic tonight is women against women. I think that topic reflects our bias, basically that women tend to be against one another. They talk about each other. They're down on one another. We're going to explore that topic tonight, and I'd like to start at the very beginning with something I find interesting. A research study done recently that found that women's attitudes about women begin at the preschool age. They investigated the Saturday morning television commercials and found that little girls were much more favorably disposed to products that were advertised by little boys than they were if little girls had appeared on the commercials. So from the very beginning, women don't seem to take one another too seriously.
I find that probably is true. I don't know exactly what causes that. I hardly think that it's a natural thing. I just imagine that it begins with the socialization process, you know, as soon as we were all born. But I've seen it manifested at a later age in junior high. I remember a couple of years ago when I was doing my student teaching, I had a ninth grade class, and we were doing some experiments with some stories that were, some stories were written traditionally for girls from the girls' point of view, and other stories were written for the boys' point of view. And it was much easier to get the girls to read the boys' stories than vice versa. The men didn't seem to think that the girls' stories were really worth reading. I don't know what that says about women's attitudes toward women, mm-hmm. but that it's a reflection that, at least in part of this, in part of the society, at that age, attitudes about women are beginning to be a little less favorable than attitudes toward men.
Were the plots different? For example, the women having tea parties and the men playing pirates. Or?
Now, if I remember correctly, one of the stories was a kind of a plot summary of a movie that Patty Duke was in at the time. And it dealt a lot with personality and self-development. And the other story was about a race driver at the time.
Well, I think it becomes apparent to children at a very early age that the male role is more rewarding, in a sense, societally. That is, that men just come out on top, and people have done studies in which they found that girls wanting to be tomboys, that is, engaging in male types of activities, is more acceptable than boys engaging in any sort of female, traditionally female type activities. And that's really because male activities are better somehow. And I think children learn that quite easily.
I think one thing we better emphasize from the very beginning, we're not defining a one role as female or one role as male. And that's simply the way the culture has directed males and females, and it's not necessarily correct or like that all over the world.
Mm-hmm. I'm remembering back to my own childhood when I always wanted to do the things that boys did and play with the boys instead of the girls, because somehow it seemed like the odds were stacked in their favor. Boys seemed to have more fun. They got dirtier, they were louder, they did more adventurous things, and that's the kind of things that I wanted to do. It seemed like it would be more fun than sitting under a tree mm-hmm. having a tea party. Mm-hmm. And I think that accounts for the fact that for a long time I've usually chosen men for friends instead of women, because somehow the things that they did seemed more interesting.
Yeah, I think that's illustrated when we get older and when we become teenagers, start becoming interested in men. I remember when I was in high school, I had 4 or 5 girlfriends, but we always had an agreement that if we had made plans to go out to a movie on Saturday night, and a boy called us, that we would immediately break our arrangement with a girlfriend so that we could go mm-hmm. out with a boy. It was just understood amongst all of us.
Yeah, I think that illustrates that boys don't have to do that because they have control about who they go out with and when. So they don't have the same kind of conflict. That is, a boy who makes arrangements with other boys isn't going to be asked out by a girl. He's mm-hmm. going to do the asking, so he can avoid those kinds of conflicts.
Well, it was obvious to me even then that the most important relationships were the relationships with the boys, and that the only reason that I went out with girls is because I didn't have a boy to go out with, and this is the way we get to see movies and, mm-hmm. you know, go out to get a pizza. And they really weren't that, my girlfriends really weren't that important.
I'm thinking back to something that I think has been discussed on this program before, that especially in the high school situation, a woman's status very much depends upon the man's status that she is dating at the time. If you are a very important woman, if you're going out with the football hero or with the basketball hero.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I agree that you define your status by the man, and it doesn't really make any difference who your best girlfriend is. Because girlfriends, at least when I was going to high school, you could have the most popular girl in high school having a girlfriend who wasn't in that circle. But the girlfriend was a private girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
Your relationship with the same sex, it was always when you were at home, and you might tell secrets to that person, but it wasn't nearly as public as all of the relationships with men that helped define how popular you were or how big a person you were in high school.
Yeah, but on the other side, it must be said that men raise their status by the kinds of women that they go out with, or lower their status by the kinds of women they go out with too. I mean, a boy who is very high status can raise his status even more by going out with an attractive
mm-hmm.
female. So, you know, the opposite
works
too.
That fits into the whole picture of women against women, though, because that puts us in a very competitive situation. You want to look good so that you can get the man that will help define your status. And that looking good isn't enough. You've got to look better or be better than the other woman so that he'll pick you instead of her.
I have an example of that. I'm doing my thesis research in advertising, and I was reading a advertising text the other day, and there was a list of characteristics and facts, quote unquote, that advertising had learned about women and men. And one of the facts that they picked up about women was that a woman will look at a picture of a nude woman longer than a man will, and their explanation for it was that she was looking for points of comparison. Mm-hmm. So it seems like from the very beginning we're put into a rivalry, competitive relationship with women.
Mm-hmm. I think I could agree with that. And women become important as points of comparison
mm-hmm.
or as rivals
mm-hmm.
rather than important for specific qualities
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. that they might have. I think that this continues later on in life. I was reading about a professional golfer, a woman on the PGA tour, Marlene Hagg. And there's a picture of Marlene in white knee-high boots and tight white pants. And all of this is also described. It takes up about a third of the article. But she was saying that women golfers can't expect to be to draw the kind of crowds that a man golfer can. She says it's natural that if you want to see someone hit a golf ball, you'll go see Jack Nicklaus or Arnold Palmer put it out there 300 yards. Now, if you want to see a stripper, chances are you'd rather see a woman than a man. And she divides things into that way. Basically, the men are the athletes, and the women on the professional golf tour are there for entertainment, and they should expect to draw lower crowds, play for lower purses. And I'm wondering if you have anything in your experience where
a woman...
I'm expecting
that there are quite a few women golfers who wouldn't agree with her.
Nevertheless, she is the one that got a three-column article in the New York Times.
Of course.
But do either of you have anything in your experience where a woman, perhaps who has already made it in a profession, in some male-dominated field, then might turn around and put down other women?
Well, I can think of something that you just triggered off earlier about an article I read in the Kansas City Daily or Kansas City Star, in which... women advertisers who were the head of big companies like cosmetics companies and things were coming under a lot of pressure by organizations like NOW because they were misrepresenting women or representing them in traditionally unfavorable ways, I suspect. And these were women who had like made it in male-dominated fields and yet were continuing the stereotype of women as, you know, kind of scatterbrained women and housewife types who had to look young to be beautiful, for example. And they were kind of resisting this and kind of resenting it in addition to that. That is, after they had made it to the top in a male-dominated field, they were angry about being accused of putting down women, which in effect they really are doing. And that's kind of how they made it.
Okay, you know? I don't have any kind of, you know, I just have speculations about why that might be. But I think most women who have made it to the top in a traditionally male field have really had to struggle and fight in more ways than one, in more than just the professional sense of it, but I'm sure that in a lot of ways they've been dealing with the so-called masculine woman image. And I can see their being reactionary to that kind of thing and trying to preserve in themselves the traditional image of the feminine woman. I think that makes perfect sense to me that would happen.
Yeah, it's not like unlike blacks who've made it to the top who will say that if you try hard enough, you can do anything you want. You just have to be motivated and try hard. Those are often called Uncle Toms. But the same kind of thing goes on. There has to be some sort of justification for all the work you've gone through.
An article in the Wall Street Journal of a couple of months ago pressed this point a little bit further. It was written by a woman, by Grace Heckinger. And it talked about professional women at a business level, at a faculty level, who knife upcoming women in the back, professionally speaking, not recommending them for advancement, making them prove themselves even more than the male candidate. And the way she suggested it might be accounted for is that she says, in many professional fields, women have long been so totally dependent on men and so conditioned to the acceptance of male written rules that the few women who have gone to the top are still trying to prove their legitimacy by adopting those same rules with a vengeance. To appear to favor a female applicant thus becomes a sign of weakness, suggesting that if you've made it, pretty much had to struggle to get there, and you don't want to appear weak
Well, there are probably a lot of other things going on, I suspect, too. I mean, it could, in some ways, being a token woman on a faculty, for example, is a very nice position. And the more women you get on the faculty, then the less your power as a woman in the token woman. And so I suspect there's some self-interest involved with a lot of women. And in addition to that, there's this thing about if you have to struggle, then you want other people to have to struggle.
Mm-hmm. And I think that makes a lot of sense.
Well, I think that under my instigation here, we've started to put a little bit of blame on women for blaming others. Let's look at some of the societal attitudes that might underlie this. Shirley, I think you've worked on some research relating to this.
Okay, well, I'll just mention a couple of things that have gone on in the literature, in the psychological literature that I'm familiar with, in which people have demonstrated that both men and women devalue women and will attribute less valued personality characteristics to them. For example, in the McKee and Sheriff's studies that were done in the 1950s, they found that asking men and women to assign adjectives to things to men or to women, most of the favorable adjectives were assigned to men. They were described as easygoing and informal and humorous and witty and industrious, etc. And most of the unfavorable adjectives were assigned to women. And they were things like snobbish, submissive, vain, touchy, moralistic, fearful, etc.
Could I inject a note in there about that article? I'm familiar with that, too, and I've used it two semesters in a lecture that I give on semantics in women and the meanings of words. And I've picked a lot of those words that Sheriff and McKee found were traditionally, you know, applied to men and traditionally applied to women. And I've conducted very informal kind of study. Actually, not a study, just I presented the words to the people in the classes and asked them to categorize them. And I don't know, this is probably just indicative of young college people, but a lot of the people in those classes refused to categorize them that way any longer. They said that they didn't see them that way anymore,
mm-hmm.
traditionally either male or female. And I've also run across the same kind of thing in some research that I've done. In the 70s and late 60s, young people's attitudes about each other, men and women, are becoming more alike. They're not so much divided on sex terms anymore, which I think is a positive kind of change if it's really happening.
Yeah, I think people are struggling with this now. It's not clear to me at this point, though, how much of these feelings or these this resistance to categorize according to sex really affects behavior any differently, and or even attitudes. You know, it's become socially approved not to assign sex stereotypes in the college community.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you, even though a lot of people, you wouldn't find a college population attributing laziness and stupidity to blacks because that's not socially acceptable anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a bad thing to do, just like it's not socially acceptable to attribute things like an emotional to women anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, maybe that's a sign of real progress. You know, I consider that a good thing. I just don't know how really strongly this is felt, because in research that's done recently, like in the 1970s, in which attitudes are covertly gotten to instead of overtly gotten to, the same results appear. That is, in this study that Feederson, Kiesler, and Goldberg did, in which they had subjects evaluate paintings by either men and women, they devaluate the women's work when it's just a contest entry. And they don't know that this is a successful person. It's only when the painting is a winner, a contest winner, that there's no differences in evaluations. But I'm sure if you would have asked those subjects, you know, are women less good painters, they would have said no.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's really unclear
how much. Maybe chances are it's just the first step in a long process. And chances are, too, that it may just remain on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And some other kind of deeper things will have to change before behavioral changes occur.
I think the stereotypes are really, have gotten much more subtle as we've gotten, as the years have progressed. I mean, it's much harder to find a sexist advertisement, at least overtly, although, you know, underlying this, there's a lot of it. Or do you think that they're overtly sexist?
Well, I'm doing my thesis on on advertising and the images in advertising. And yes, I think they're getting worse. Overtly sexist. But that's, you know, that's one of the
with things. With a sense of humor about it, or
me?
With a sense of humor. I mean, like, I've seen some obviously sexist commercials that seem to be like tongue in cheek or something like that.
Well, I don't know about television. Magazine advertisements don't seem to be tongue-in-cheek. They seem to be, you know, just overtly sexist. And I'm getting all these kinds of feedback about how those are the most successful ads.
It's interesting. I think, too, that at least on television, there are a lot of male sexist kinds of advertisement in which the male is portrayed in a certain way. And I wonder if men must not get irritated or tired of being compared to this virile, sexy, good-looking hunk on the television, you know, that there are as many, I suppose, like that as there are for women.
Yeah, that's probably true. I haven't paid that much attention. Although the ads that I really like are the beer commercials, you know, the sailing and doing all these fantastically adventurous things in Australia and the Orient. Ads like that are just not directed toward women.
If you live with gusto,
right.
You're a male.
Yeah.
You only go around once in life.
Mm-hmm. We're all in this together, and it's two men and a horse. And there isn't a woman involved at all. Okay, well
we kind of diverged there.
Getting back to this study that you were talking about, one thing that I found very interesting, it seems like it's a terrible, vicious circle. People do not judge a woman or her creative works as worth anything unless someone has already judged her or her creative works as worth something. It's like the old thing about you have to get experience to get a job, but how do you get a job without having experience? It sounds like, according to this, women are trapped in that, by themselves, as well as by men.
It's hard to respond to.
Was there
I think that sums it up.
I can't remember. Was there any difference between women viewing each other and men viewing women?
The study was conducted with just women, so we don't have any evidence about them. Yeah, I don't know. I think that people are in a very difficult spot now. I mean, women are in some ways dependent on people who are already establishing the norms and who's good and who's the best, and those people are typically males, and so it's hard to get out of that.
Yeah, I don't know why. I didn't know, you know, talking about a solution to that kind of thing. I think the best thing is to do what we're doing right now. Just talk about it and get people thinking about it, and hopefully they'll start recognizing those things in their daily interactions with people.
And also doing a stronger thing, which is things like the Affirmative Action Committee has done, which is making people change their behavior.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely.
And then, definitely. You know, hoping that some of the attitudes involved
Definitely. I think that's one of the most positive things as far as changing. It just, you start changing people's behavior, like the Bims, Daryl Bim pointed out. Seems to be indicative that after a person has been forced to change his behavior, his or her behavior, their attitudes start to change to coincide with their behavior.
All right. I hope that we've been giving our listeners something to think about, and you can think about it for the next couple of minutes, and then give us a call and share your questions and your comments. Our telephone number is 864-4530. We'll be taking a short station break, and then we'll be back with A Feminist Perspective. Okay. You'll have to ask out there.
Well, I think it's been going pretty well.
Yeah. Come on.
It's remarkable how much Sally resembles Sarah. Have you noticed? Shirley?
Please be careful about hitting the table because the microphones pick it up very, very well.
Okay. I wonder how much we've been doing that.
Well, when I first started this, I thought I wasn't going to be able to find anything.
How appropriate to have this ad now.
Well, what are we doing now? Just listening to the station break so we know when to go back in. That was very quick.
Like, I'm going for another half hour.
Thank you for rejoining us. Our guests tonight are Vicki Hamer and Shirley Feldman. Our topic is Women Against Women. And I'd like to turn the conversation a little bit to one specific group of women talking about one other specific group of women. The feminist movement has come in for a lot of criticism from women. Let me read some of the more interesting quotes of Women Against Women and hear your reactions. Two women wrote a book called Purr, Baby, Purr, started one article in the book with this paragraph. No human relationship gives a woman more happiness, pleasure, fulfillment, or purpose than marriage. Naturally, it is under full attack by the feminists, the same people who would take our babies away from us and put them in state nurseries so that we could march off to work in the mines. These women would take the love out of sex, the maternalism out of motherhood, and the romance out of marriage. Many of them would do away with marriage altogether. And Midge Dector, quoted in the Los Angeles Times, talks about the feminist movement and says that women's lib seems to be an easy way for women to cop out on all the major issues of their lives. And a vice president of the National Bank of Fort Benning, Georgia, who is a woman and has been a banker for 25 years, says, those who are fooling around with liberation and that sort of thing are mostly those who can't hold down a job anyway. Now here we have one specific group of women against another group.
The earlier part of our discussion, which is that women often attack women. And rather than seeing the status quo or things the way they are as being somehow detrimental to their lives, no matter what kind of lives they want to lead, they lash out at other women. And
I don't know. I don't know in this particular instance if this is any more indicative of women attacking women than just people attacking people when they disagree with each other. I haven't thought about it that much, but I'd like to respond anyway to that first quote. I think that that first quote is indicative of the kind of overreaction that not just the female opposition, but the male opposition has to feminism. I don't want to be on the defensive, but when the two women who wrote the book talk about state nurseries and marching women off to the mines, that's ridiculous. I suppose, you know, in a country as big as ours, with as many people as there are, and with as many divergent views about what's right and the right way to live a life, there are women who want children in state nurseries and want everybody working in the mines. But I haven't talked to any. I've talked to women who say, I want a chance to develop my mind, use my talents. I found that my child is not in any way worse off for spending 6 or 8 hours a day in a nursery. I find that we get along a lot better than when I was with the child 24 hours a day.
Now, you don't think that this has anything to do with womanhood, per se, woman against woman? You said it was people against people, and yet I hear you responding out of your own being as a woman to these women. It seems to me like the issues involved and also some of the emotions are tied into being a woman. What we're dealing with here is the sex role, which is
being a woman. You know, these issues are women's issues. But at least, you know, child care has been traditionally defined as a woman's job. So, but I've heard men respond in similar ways. I don't know. You know, I don't know what the statistics are about whether more women than men respond adversely to feminism. But I can understand why women respond the way they do, I think. When you've been defined traditionally in terms of one of two roles, mother and housewife, and you hear someone saying that these aren't enough, a person who has lived their entire life that way, I can see all kinds of variables, as you were saying, interacting there.
Yeah, I'm sure that they find it very threatening.
They find it very threatening, I'm sure. And I can understand how they would interpret the situation as trying to take my whole definition away from me. I know women who want children and a career.
Yeah, this
and when every man can have that, it seems ridiculous to me that a woman can't have that too. I definitely think that men should have the opportunity to raise children. I mean, I'm saying that I've never had the experience, but I'm sure it's a very rewarding experience. Why should they be denied that?
Yeah, I think that part of the reactions of these women is, well, a part, at least, a result of the way the women's movement started out and the kind of approach it took. I think that it has been, at least until very, very recently, geared to a certain kind of woman. That is the intellectual, middle class, upper middle class woman who has some achievement, motivation in the sense of career, etc., etc. And because of that, I think these women who don't have careers or see themselves as being left out, and I think that they have been to a certain extent. I don't think that the women's movement has tried to get to the lower class woman, at least until recently. You know, it's like any other movement. It starts out with the elite and then kind of sits down gradually.
It starts out with the people who have time to think about those things.
Right. Yeah. And so I can understand how they might feel this way.
And I think it's also unique in that I see it as starting internally, because for a woman to make her first public protest, whether it's to her husband or her family or her parents, just to say, no, I don't want to do that, she has already gone through the revolution inside herself, because she has put aside her own opinions, society's opinions, that this is your role, and she has taken the very non-traditional, non-feminine, aggressive action that for a woman it is quite unusual. And so it seems to me whenever a woman gets involved to the least extent in the feminist movement, this is, transformation has already taken place inside her.
I think, okay. I agree with you about when the feminist movement first began reviving again in the mid-60s, there wasn't a place for the housewife. It put down the role of housewife alone for the intellectual woman, but the woman who was a housewife and who didn't have a college education didn't have any place to go, didn't have any place to turn. She just was bombarded with all of these messages about how her work wasn't fulfilling, and that I'm sure she interpreted as being, well, these people don't think that what I'm doing is worthwhile, that I'm useless. And let's see, what was I going to say?
Well, I just think it's important that we think of those people as people to win over. That is, I think it's important to gear the movement to the needs of those particular women.
Well, I don't know about winning them over. This is what I was going to say. I think that, at least for me, I went through a period, and then I realized, oh, wait a minute, this is a valid choice. If a woman wants to choose to be a housewife and a mother, that's absolutely fine.
Oh, well, you misunderstood me. I'm not saying we should win them over and tell them to go out and get work. Not at all. I'm saying that they should be our allies, and that they should see the movement as providing freedom, as much freedom for women as there is for men, and that women have as much opportunity to pick out the kind of life that they want to live. And certainly, being a mother and a housewife is certainly an acceptable kind of thing if the woman chooses that freely and if she can derive satisfaction from that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, however, you know, a lot of them aren't happy.
Right.
And it's not because they don't have a job, but because, well, they're not really looked up to in any way by their husbands, for example.
This is one of the things that I see the feminist movement having to do now, starting to change the image of housewife and mother, and really attaching a new kind of importance to it. It really, you know, the unpaid domestic. I think in a lot of ways, on one level, a woman's on a pedestal in that role, but on a social, economic level, she doesn't really get that much reward from the people around her that she's supposed to be getting. And we have to, you know, we have to start changing the image of the housewife-mother role.
Perhaps
more positively oriented.
Perhaps among housewives themselves, so that
really,
no one says, again, I am
just
a housewife.
I mean, I think that's perfectly...
It reminds me of something that Groucho Marx once said. He said, I would never even consider joining a club that would admit a person like me as a member. kind of the idea that... well, I think you get the idea. I was going to bring this up about fields that traditionally have been dominated by women, such as elementary school teaching, secretaries, airline stewardess, librarians, that I think, at least in the recent past of the feminist movement, have been attacked. And the women in those positions...
Oh, I think, there's been really a lot of pressure on women not to choose those roles, to choose something that's traditionally male. I agree with you. I think that's one of the problems.
with the movement.
And that kind of thing happens.
I was wondering if
just a reactionary.
Yeah, thing. I don't think the movement would have. I'm not really familiar with this, but I can imagine that the movement wouldn't have attacked secretarial kinds of work unless secretaries were didn't get paid very much and didn't have very many benefits and couldn't make very many decisions, etc., etc. It's not that it's predominated by women that brings it under attack by the movement, I suspect, but rather that in our society it's just a lower level kind of occupation. And in terms of the kinds of rewards you can derive from it.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. It reminded me of something that a little study that we did last year, in which we asked our students to rate how successful a woman would be in an occupation and how successful a man would be in an occupation. And of course, this wasn't. It had women, men, there were a lot of variables manipulated so that it wasn't obvious to the subjects what we were doing. And even with traditionally female occupations like elementary school teaching and nursing, etc., our subjects thought that men would be more successful than women. And we couldn't find any occupations that people thought women would be better than men, even the traditionally female ones. And I think that that indicates, at least to some extent, that success is a male word in our society. The best cooks are men. The best dress designers are men. And presumably, if men went into nursing, they'd be the best nurses. So that's why I said I'm not sure. When you said earlier that things were changing, that's why I said, I'm not so sure that things aren't changing that much.
One thing that I see as an encouraging sign is, again, starting at the lower interpersonal level. I just picked up on the newsstand the July issue of Red Book magazine, a woman's magazine, not necessarily of the genre that MS is. And one of the headline articles, Can Women Really Trust One Another? And the general message of the article is that deep, intimate friendships are very, very important among women, and they have a special characteristic. You cannot have this kind of friendship between a woman and a man, and that more and more women are coming to recognize their need for this kind of a sharing relationship, and that as a result of the women's movement, it is becoming more and more acceptable for women to go places together and have this kind of relationship. I found that very encouraging, I guess, starting at a small level, and maybe if they can be successful in relationships like this, then we can attribute more successful traits to women. Let me invite our listeners, if you have any comments or questions, to give us a call. Our number is 864-4530.
I'd like to add that, getting back to the rivalry that we experienced in high school, since I've been in college, and especially in graduate school, I've not been aware of that at all, that rivalry between women. As a matter of fact, in graduate school, the relationships that I see, anyway, happening in my own life, are much more equal between the men and the women. We don't seem to be defined so much by traditional sex roles as when we were younger.
How has that affected your relationship with women?
Well, I really can't say. I'm close to two or three women,
mm-hmm.
but I'm not any closer to them than I am. That's not true. I think I probably am closer to the women than the men.
One of the things that the article in Red Book pointed out was that there seems to be a time for this type of friendship in a woman's life. Basically, I think it's when there is no more need for competition
then women find they can settle down into a good, intimate friendship with another woman. The examples they used in the magazine, after a woman was married and had had a home and had children, and the children had started to school and were 5 or 6 years old, all right, she already had a man, she had a family. At that point, the children left, and then she had time for someone else in her life that would in no way compete mm-hmm. at all, and then without the pressure of competition could develop a close friendship. And from my experience in graduate school is kind of the breathing time. Okay, you've already made it in, all of the scholarships have been allocated, you just do your work and you don't have to worry for 2 or 3 years until it comes time to get a job. And at that point, men and women again are competition, but in the interim.
Right, but at that time, women are competing competing as much with men as with other women.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder if women competing against women, at least in graduate school, etc., doesn't revolve around the achievement or professional kinds of goals, but around the personal things. For example, you mentioned something about women who are already married don't have to compete against other women because they've got their men. Well, that may be true, at least to some extent, but I can sure think of anecdotal evidence in which that isn't true. That is, women compete against women in how good their house is and how good a cook they are and what kind of entertainment they can offer. And also against other women, that is, women who don't have that secure relationship with their husbands or even have a security but are insecure in themselves often feel threatened by other women, particularly if they're single. That is, you know, so it goes into a different realm, perhaps. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that perhaps competition just doesn't disappear but just takes on new forms depending on the lifestyle mm-hmm. that you're in at the time.
I'm reading one of the conclusions from the article and saying that the women's movement has placed a greater value on relationships among women, made women think in terms of friendship as a good in itself, not as a poor substitute for male companionship. And here we get back into mm-hmm. those Saturday night syndromes of high school where, sure, we'll go to the movie unless Johnny right. asks you. And they're suggesting that now we can see a value in itself to having a woman as friend. By upgrading the pleasure of a woman, to take in another woman's company, the women's movement has been able to diminish the anxiety women often feel when they are not sought by men. So they're suggesting that by changing the attitudes women hold toward one another, we are also changing our attitudes toward men. And I believe that.
It makes sense. I'd like to, I just thought of something. When we were talking earlier, before the program started, you mentioned attitudes about women preferring, in their professional context, preferring men to women. Well, something that I have discovered in contact with doctors and dentists, that women are an awful lot gentler than men. So I tend to prefer women in those kinds of professional contexts. They're aware of you as a woman and, you know where it hurts and where it doesn't hurt. And they're really a lot gentler than men.
All right. I'm thinking back over my professional contacts. At this point, my dentist is a man. My doctor is a woman. How about both of you?
Well, my doctor's a man and my dentist is a man, but the contacts that I've had with his nurse and the contacts and with the oral hygienist at the dentist, I just went mm-hmm. to the dentist this morning to get my teeth cleaned, so I'm thinking about how gentle she was, and I remembered contacts with dentists that, mm-hmm. you know, the big hands just aren't gentle.
The person I rely on for information about finances and about investments is a woman, because I feel that she understands my situation making my way for myself financially, mm-hmm. much more than a man would.
Mm-hmm. I know for sure that if I were going to pick, if I were in need of a psychologist or a lawyer, I would pick a woman.
All right, my attitudes are starting to get in the way as soon as you said lawyer, because I'm thinking, but I've read that it's so much harder for a woman because of attitudes toward women. Juries look down on women lawyers, and so if I really wanted to win the case philosophically, I might want a woman, but pragmatically, worrying about what the jury might think, I'd probably pick a man.
I was not aware of that. I have just read cases where women have won, you know, fantastic court cases, and you know, I don't know what the odds are.
I don't know. I can't think of anything where I would pick someone just on the basis of that person's sex. I guess if I was having legal trouble, I'd want to go to the best lawyer.
Yeah. Of course, how do we determine who the best is? And we get back to the vicious circle again.
I don't know. That's really a hard thing to do. Except in maybe the area of psychology.
Mm-hmm.
Where I would, if I were going into something like therapy, I'd want a woman because I think that she has an additional advantage over the man. At least with a woman client.
Mm-hmm.
But after that, it's hard to think of anything like that.
Well, let's get back to something a little bit more personal, and that is just friendships. Now I'm asking for supposition since we don't have a male panelist, but do you think that friendships among men are different than friendships among women? We've spoken quite a bit about competition being a factor in women's friendships. What about two men who are best friends? Do you think their relationship is in any way different than two very close women friends?
I just wouldn't want to speculate about that at all.
I don't know, but I think that at least intuitively, I think some of the problems we raise concerning women's relationships with each other also occur for men. Maybe, you know, maybe not to the same extent, maybe not in the exact same ways, but I'm sure men feel competitive towards each other professionally and interpersonally and for the attentions of other women, just like women do. But I don't know, you know, exactly how this is manifested.
Well, just looking at the way men relate to each other from the very beginning, when you're in high school, if the guys get together, they go out and shoot baskets, or they go bowling, or they play poker, they in some way do things. And remembering back when I was with a group of women, we would generally sit around and talk. We would talk about ourselves, talk about other women, talk about things that were going on, but we would talk. And men do things together. I'm not sure how that would affect the friendship, but I think it's significant.
I don't know. I think that my stereotypes of men are that they are less inclined to share intimate kinds of things with their friends unless it's some sort of real big problem. And I don't know if that's because society sees that sharing, that intimateness, as being kind of a negative thing.
As a feminine thing.
Probably both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That somehow indicates personal weakness, that is, having to talk about these things and et cetera.
I think that's probably very true.
I think that can also build in another one of these circles, because women in the past have had friendships of that nature. That's what women did, was share some of the personal things, that perhaps it becomes even more of a need later on in life to have a friendship like that, like the magazine was talking about, when mm-hmm. other things of temporary interest have left, then you still have this personal need that perhaps a man, because he was not socialized in the same way, might not have. And yet interfering with that circle is the circle of, if it's valuable, someone else has to say it's valuable, and before they say it's valuable, someone else has to say it again.
Yeah.
And on and on. It seems like we've gone in a lot of circles this evening, but I think we've covered some interesting territory in the process. I'd like to invite all of our listeners to tune in again next week for A Feminine Perspective.
I just wanted to compliment you on your fine contact with the eye contact with the microphone.
Were you even aware of that?
No, those last 10 minutes. It was
you too. Did
I felt
great.
Sorry. You too really did great.
Boy, we were feeling it.